I've taught classes that are much larger, and when you have, you know, 100 students, you know that it's just impossible. You never can find a time when everybody can do it. But at any rate, so we'll aim to find a time that works for, or two times that work, I guess. So we've been getting into cosmology, and today, for the first time, we've really reached the point where we've got all the background for the most of the multiverse, or the bulk of the scientifically supported multiverse ideas. So I'm going to talk about those later today. Does anybody have any questions or things that are on their mind, having taken a first glance at some of this stuff? Yeah. Foam theory. Okay, so I mean, it's possible he's meaning something that I'm not thinking of. If it's what I'm thinking of, we've mentioned it a little bit at very short distances, how space-time actually it has a lot of structure, and so you can think of it as a seething foam in a sense at really, really small distances. He also may be meaning what we'll call the bubble multiverse and sort of what came first sort of idea. And so we'll talk a little bit about it, but we're not going to talk a whole lot because I don't. It becomes beyond speculative when you start talking about what came before inflation. I mean, inflation's less speculative, but we are going to talk about sort of before inflation a bit today. But it's, yeah. Yep. Okay, so just for the recorder here, the question is, what caused the universe to grow quickly, basically through inflation, and then what caused it to stop with inflation? Let me come to that in just a few minutes, because what I wanted to do initially is just sort of remind everybody where we are. So I'm going to come right back to that point, and then let me start in on that. So just a quick reminder of where we are. We started out talking about this crazy idea of the Big Bang. And with the Big Bang, we know we're expanding. And so you can extrapolate back in time and follow the temperature and energy density and gravitational strength that's around in the universe as a function of time going backwards. And because the energy density is changing, and eventually and effectively the gravitational field is getting much stronger, the interaction energies are changing. So the nature of the forces and the particles that are present all change as you go backwards. And in a sense, a lot of this is really set in motion from about 400,000 years after the Big Bang, where you have one of the last significant developments in the history of phase changes that happen as the universe is expanding, where neutral atoms are formed, so the universe becomes transparent. And we can see light from that time, so that makes it a very significant thing. Prior to that, most of the excitement really happened within the first 3 minutes, because it's during that period that you have the formation of protons and neutrons, and you have a period where protons and neutrons begin to stick together to form some of the light nuclei. And the numbers of different types of nuclei, all of which are very light, that are formed during the Big Bang, the so-called Big Bang nucleosynthesis, all happens in about that first 3 minutes. And then prior to that, you have sort of a subatomic particle soup, What happens after 400,000 years is whatever energy asymmetries there are in the universe basically will become the structure, the large-scale structure that we see in our universe. So more or less everything is already set in motion by whatever fluctuations had happened prior to that time. So within the Big Bang model, you really can't say anything once you push back far enough, because physics as we know it sort of breaks down. There's a lot of evidence to support the Big Bang, the idea that we see this light coming from 400,000 years after the start of the Big Bang, which has the characteristics you would expect. Basically, it's a black body spectrum as if it were a glowing object. The temperature is what you would expect when you account for the fact that you've had expansion of the universe, so that the roughly 3,000 degree black body now looks 4 degrees Kelvin, just based on how the universe has expanded. The ratios of all the various elements that we can measure agree with what we would calculate using basic physics we understand, which is if you take a pot of protons and neutrons and have them at a certain temperature for a certain amount of time, we actually can do that in the lab well enough in accelerators, so we know how that happens. So there's a lot of evidence to support the Big Bang. Then there are real problems with the Big Bang. Everything going backwards goes to a point, and all sorts of problems happen with equations, and you'll need quantum gravity if you really want to solve that. So I wouldn't say this tells you the Big Bang can't be true, but it's a big thorny problem where you get to a certain stage, you go, well, I just have no idea. There are problems in the Big Bang in and of itself, that the fact that the temperature of the cosmic microwave background is uniform as we look in all different directions implies that everything that we see today, the universe at that time, at 400,000 years after the Big Bang, should all have been causally connected at some point because it's all at the same temperature. And yet, if we literally extrapolate back those different positions of the universe, there are lots of the universe that wasn't in causal contact with the other pieces in a straight Big Bang. So we know that's a real problem. The flatness problem is that we've measured the geometry of the universe to be basically flat, which is very much a special case. And within general relativity, which is the framework for the Big Bang, there's no reason for that to be the case. So there needs to be some compelling piece of our cosmological theory that drives the geometry to be flat. As I said, the uniformity creates an issue because of the fact everything looks as if it had to be in causal contact. But it's also true that the non-uniformity creates an issue because we don't know how it got there in just the Big Bang theory. So that's called the large-scale structure problem. So it's pretty clear that the Big Bang does not stand alone. And there's enough evidence supporting it that whatever we put in place more or less has to duplicate or produce something which we think of as the Big Bang, because that's pretty well understood. But clearly, in and of itself, there's something else that has to happen underneath it. And what I mentioned last class and what we're going to talk about now is, I guess to say, the most fashionable thing that underlies the Big Bang. In another class or two, we'll talk about a different idea that doesn't involve this idea of inflation, which actually also gives you something that looks a lot like a Big Bang. So I'm not saying that inflation is the only way to solve the problem. So the idea that most people put underneath the Big Bang in order to solve all these various problems is called cosmic inflation. And we refer to the cosmological theory, and it's not just sort of one theory, it's a class of theories, and different details may happen, and if you go to a conference you'll have people arguing a lot about those details. But you call them hot Big Bang, inflationary hot Big Bang models. Inflation means they have this weird idea of inflation. Hot Big Bang model basically means that the energy density was very high early on and you have this expanding universe. So the idea with inflation is that the universe starts out really, really tiny, basically on the scale of a quantum fluctuation in something, maybe a space-time foam, whatever that means exactly. Okay, and then you imbue that space-time. You may have lots of quantum fluctuations happening if you could imagine there's some form of space-time. There's energy fluctuations happening all the time, and then one comes about which has particular characteristics we'll talk about in a moment, but what it does with those characteristics is it has basically an underlying massive repulsion which causes that spot to basically inflate much faster than you can imagine, faster than the speed of light. Basically, it's an exponential expansion, and it goes for a period, and then stops, at least in a small spot. And in that spot, the energy driving the inflation gets dumped into a soup of subatomic particles and energy, basically, and we have it maps directly onto what we see as the Big Bang. It answers a lot of the problems with the Big Bang, because if you start off with this quantum fluctuation having arbitrary geometry, you blow it up really big, it's going to be flat. So you have a compelling reason to have flat space in the universe. Everything started out causally connected, so the horizon problem isn't an issue. You should have everything at basically the same temperature. As this thing is expanding, quantum fluctuations in energy, so small little fluctuations in energy will happen, which will get blown up the cosmic scales, so that you're left with a universe at the end of the inflationary period that ought to have small asymmetries, which will then naturally go into the large-scale structure of the universe. And people actually have studied the quantum mechanics of this idea and looked at the basic spectrum or the number and sizes that you would expect for these asymmetries, these regions, how big and how often you should see regions of how big that have these different energies, and we call it basically a spectrum of fluctuations, and it agrees roughly with what we see for the large-scale galaxies. So it didn't have to. So the fact that it does is a pretty compelling piece of evidence for the idea of inflation. So let's see. So these different regions, that these small regions of energy density in the early stages, right after inflation, are regions that turn into regions where you have slightly more hydrogen than others, for example, because you have slightly higher energy that it condenses into these particles. And so you have more gravity, so it's there that you condense into galaxies and stars and stuff. So also you're starting out basically at a quantum fluctuation level, so you don't really go have super issues with the singularity issue. So inflation, as strange as it may seem, solves all these problems. So we had a question that came up a few minutes ago as to what really caused this inflation. And I can't really answer that problem. Nobody really knows yet. What I can do is give you a sense of the theoretical idea that people use to at least theoretically generate such a thing. So that I can do. So in quantum field theory, in the theory, you for every type of particle that exists, you talk about a field. So there's a mapping basically in the universe of of this quantum field as a function of space and time, I guess you can think of it. And when you're hypothesizing what kinds of forces exist in the universe, you have to hypothesize what kinds of interactions each of these fields can have with other fields and how much energy this field can have as it does interactions. And so, generally speaking, we think of the fields that are present in our universe, and which basically correspond to particles in the theory, as being at a minimum state of energy naturally. That we say that they're ground state. So if we were to basically picture the energy stored in a field in the universe in this theory, as a function of the value of the field, because it could take on different values in the theory, it might have something which we would call its potential, which means it might look something like this. And what we would expect to see in our universe is something that's basically at the lowest possible energy, the ground state. And so, generally speaking, in all of our work and theories in quantum mechanics and in quantum field theory, this is basically the case, right? It turns out that if we were to create space-time where the field itself didn't have a value that corresponded to its basic ground state, but somehow had a non-zero potential energy. So somehow it was created with such a value that it had energy in and of itself. It wasn't at its lowest energy level. When you do that, in the theory, it actually puts a repulsive term into the general relativity. This feeds directly into the term in general relativity that we call the cosmological constant that causes the space-time to expand. And so this is sort of the scheme that they use. The problem is that theoretically what they have to do is figure out a type of potential where you can have this expansion happening very fast and then slow down. And so the way that they do that is they describe the particle in the theory as something like this, and when you have the initial fluctuation in space-time, the particle's energy is over here, and it will, like most things do, will go down to its ground state, but it does so slowly for a while, and then it rolls down very quickly to its ground state. So you can create a model for a particle in quantum field theory such that for a period of time it appears as if it's in a basic excited state and causes this massive repulsion, the inflationary mechanism, and then the field will actually change. Now this field permeates the universe. So what happens is it doesn't actually change all in one spot. You have quantum fluctuations in the value of the field everywhere you go. So the field itself is actually jiggling a little bit around its initial value, and because it has a lower energy when it fluctuates down this way, it will basically slowly roll down in time. But the truth is, it may be a particular point in space as it's expanding where you'll actually get the fluctuation to drop it down here. And as it drops down, so in a lot of space maybe it doesn't, so as it drops down, that's the point where inflation actually stops. And so, in a sense, you have this big expanding universe, and then as this thing goes down, you'll get in a small region, the inflation will slowly stop. Will stop. It happens very fast, but basically, you'll have, instead of inflation, it starts expanding less and less fast, and that's sort of the region that became our universe in this picture. So there's a reason sort of I avoided this, but in response to the question, I do try to go into it in a bit more detail in Visions of the Multiverse. So there I use some diagrams and try to paint the picture for you. What this leads to, which actually gets us well into later in the lecture, so I'll come back to this, is that if you have inflation starting in some region of space, because of the way that we're modeling it, you can have a quantum fluctuation in the value of this field, which we call the inflaton, and it would correspond in principle to a type of particle that maybe we can discover someday, but we don't know what it is yet. You may have a fluctuation in the value of the field which will cause inflation to stop at a certain point. And at this point, you might have the birth of what we would perceive as our Big Bang. But you could also have that at other points. And at the same time, you can continue to have this matrix in between them to continue to expand. And so here is one form of a multiverse, which basically, when you asked about your friend who asked you about space-time foam, you basically have this inflating space-time matrix, and within it, in spots, you'll basically get what you think of as something similar to our universe happening, and that's called a bubble multiverse. And since, as I hope will become clear over the next couple of lectures, the physical characteristics of the forces and particles in nature depend on the details of the structure of the space-time, you can actually have different physical laws in these different regions of space. I mean, things can be totally different. You can have different strength particles, you can have different mass particles, different types of forces and stuff like that. So I don't know that leaves you feeling warm and fuzzy, but that's there are ways in which you can theoretically cause massive repulsion within general relativistic equations that basically are related to quantum field theory, or a theory of how forces and particles interact. You do have to hypothesize the existence of a new particle, which basically corresponds to this field. And what you're saying is that when this bit of space-time comes into existence, that particle basically is at an excited state. So if you want to imagine that I can make a spring just appear right in front of me, generally speaking, I might do that. The spring would come into being basically at its natural length, not compressed or stretched. If it came into being compressed or stretched, so it would be in an excited state, then you would happen to have this particular mechanism going on. So that's the mathematical way in which this sort of is modeled. But we don't really know what does it. One point that comes out of this is if you have this kind of game, you can actually look at this inflating matrix as having sort of always been there. So you can actually construct a theory where you don't really have a beginning of time, which may sound pretty strange, but you basically have this inflating matrix and these universes can be popping up. So it's something that's called eternal inflation. So we'll come back to that, but really for the purposes of this class, well, not actually, because we're going to be talking a bit more about this stuff, but the basic idea is through some mechanism we have this idea of inflation that happens. And I want you to understand one aspect of this, which is the concept of inflation fixes all the problems with Big Bang. And that's sort of independent of the mechanism through which inflation happened, which is a very valid thing to ask. But we can actually talk seriously about this strange idea of inflation and ask, is there evidence that inflation happened without having the quantum mechanical mechanism of what exactly drove that repulsion in space-time? All right, you don't necessarily have to have that answered. So we should just bear that in mind, because it turns out that we do have evidence that inflation may have happened. Okay, so again, last time I brought up a couple of things that were surprises. Well, some not so much of a surprise. Since we know there's large-scale structure in the universe, if the Big Bang Theory is true, you better be able to look back at the cosmic microwave background radiation that's coming at us, and you better find small fluctuations in the color or its energy, basically, because those are the fluctuations that lead to the large-scale structure of the universe. And so for many years, people looked with increasingly sensitive instruments and didn't find it, and we're starting to actually get a bit worried, because many scientists were pretty comfortable with this idea of the Big Bang because it's so well supported, and yet this really important piece of it was missing. So there was a big sigh of relief in the cosmological community when they sent up a satellite that actually found variations in the temperature of the cosmic microwave background of 1 part in 10 to the 5th, which is sufficient to actually give the large-scale structure of the universe. So that was very cool. It was a surprise, I think, when people looked at the sizes of those fluctuations and were able to determine that the universe is flat. And I think we'll probably mention again, but I talked about that last time. And then there was something that completely came out of the blue when people did basically the Hubble measurement much more to much larger distances using supernovas. So again, the idea is to use the brightness of supernovas to look at distances to galaxies and then look at the redshift, that is the frequency shift of the spectral lines, in order to determine the velocity of recession of the galaxy. What they found was that velocity of recession was actually changing over the history of the universe, and what they determine is that our universe's expansion is actually accelerating, and that really came as a major surprise. And it requires the addition of a term which involves energy into Einstein's equations. People are currently looking for it. We're going to talk more about it. I'll show you more evidence for it. But we call this dark energy because the term that you have to add to Einstein's equations basically has units of energy. It could be that the mechanism that is causing this acceleration is something very similar to the mechanism that caused inflation at the start of the universe. There are reasons to believe that they are not the same mechanism, but you could, for example, it could be two different particles that are doing it with different characteristics, but we don't really know yet. All right, so this is now with the most sensitive instrument as of a few years ago that had been up. There's one that's actually more sensitive that's up now taking data, called the Planck satellite. But at the moment, the WMAP is the most sensitive one that's produced results and published them. And this is basically a picture of the full night sky, taking everything out except the cosmic microwave background, and using false color to show you the different temperatures along the sky. So you can see the pink and the blue basically are varying by 1 part in 10 to the 5th in terms of their temperature. But the structure that you see here, basically, if I were to make a similar map of the large-scale structure of our universe in terms of galactic clusters or something like that, you would see, in terms of frequency of large and small spots and stuff, you'd basically see the same structure. This type of structure maps directly into the large-scale structure of the universe. when you look at the sizes of those spots, this is the way in which we've actually measured the large-scale geometry of the universe, because we're effectively looking at something that where the light was emitted 13.2 billion light years away. So the light has actually gone across a lot of the universe to get to us. And if the large-scale geometry of the universe is curved, then a spot of a certain size that far away is going to look smaller or larger. And if it's flat, it will look, relatively speaking, you know, right in the middle of these. And it turns out from our understanding of what the nature of the age and the material that was in the universe at the time, there are pretty good ideas as to how big these spots should be. And it turns out then if we go and we look at the cosmic microwave background carefully, we don't see the spots being small like this or large like that. We see them being exactly what we would have expected if the universe happened to have flat space. So this is this was a bit of a surprise, and it's a very important thing to know. All right, so this gets us pretty much where we stopped at the end of class last time. Okay, so if we have inflation, we start out really small, and things are blowing up really, really big, vastly larger than our observable universe. So it gives us a picture where we have, here you are, here's our observable universe, and then we have what are called particle and event horizons. So maybe let me not distinguish between those carefully. Let's just call it, a way to think about it is, since the space is expanding, as we go further away, space is moving faster from us, and there will come a point where space is moving so fast from us that a light signal could never reach us, because basically it's receding from us faster than the speed of light. You okay with that? So that means there's a finite region of the universe, which I'm going to call the event horizon here, outside of which it is not physically possible for us to ever be causally connected. You can wait forever, and a signal from out here would never reach you.
Is that just because of the rate of expansion?
Yeah. So space here is expanding faster than the light coming from here could go this way, so it'll never get to you. You can think of it as if you're paddling up a river that is going near a waterfall, so it's moving really, really fast, and you can paddle all you want, you're still going to go down that waterfall, right?
So, I mean, according to your definition of a universe, wouldn't that imply it's like a separate universe?
There you are. So, with the idea of inflation, and I think you can argue this may be the case even without inflation, because if you look in all directions, the structure, the basic structure is the same everywhere, and it seems to be the same going all the way out. And there may be some other reasons, but you can basically from that sort of infer that you must be looking at a part of something bigger, because you don't see big changes as if you might expect if you went to edges. The other thing is the space is flat. If the space were dramatically positively curved, you would basically expect to be able to send a light beam, it goes all the way around and comes back, and so everything would sort of be consistent with an enclosed space-time. But we don't have that. But the truth is, with inflation, you have, it's just natural that we would have a greater reality that is vastly larger than our observable universe, and also vastly larger than our potentially observable universe. So by our definition of universe, where we've defined the universe to be everything that we could possibly experience, so we have to be causally connected to it, What is out here is outside of our universe. So these regions are forever separated from us. But these regions all come from the same basic fluctuation in space-time in the inflating medium that stop things. So if you argue that the structure of the space-time, which we're going to talk about when we get into string theory in a couple of classes, if you argue that the structure of that space-time is what really determines the masses of the particles and the nature of the forces and all the physical constants that determine basically the universe that we're in and whether you can form stars and carbon and have life and, as we know it and things like that, all of this comes from one basic fluctuation in this inflaton field, in this inflating matrix. So this universe that gets born out here is very similar to us. So all that's different in the world out here from in here is just the initial conditions of the particle, of the structure. So you'll have one pattern of the fluctuations here, one pattern of the fluctuations here. Once that pattern of fluctuations is set, basically everything else progresses with only quantum fluctuate, quantum uncertainty being the thing that leads you from being able to put it all on a computer and completely predict it.
What's the particle horizon?
We can't see beyond 13.2 billion light years because the universe becomes opaque. But if we were looking at neutrinos, which aren't bothered by charged particles, we in fact could look further. So particle horizon would be sort of... you can think of it as if you could look all the way back to 13.7 billion light years right now, you would sort of be seen to the particle horizon. If you now wait forever, effectively this particle horizon will be the event horizon. There, it depends on what you're looking at. When we talk about observable universe, you're actually asking if you take a big telescope so what can you actually see? And we can actually see light coming from the cosmic microwave background that was emitted at 400,000 years after the Big Bang. But there were particles in the universe that earlier in the universe. So if you can imagine a process that happened right after the Big Bang that involved neutrinos, those neutrinos at some basically would have been freely moving toward us from that time, but we just can't see them very well. So if you sort of think about, if we could see everything, including all types of particles, so we could basically look for the equivalent of the cosmic microwave background, but look for it in neutrinos or other types of particles, then we could see a little bit further out, I guess, is that's what it is. And then...
that's just like, but we actually can't detect neutrinos?
We can detect them, but not those, and not well enough to make an image. So, yeah, I probably should throw it out of here because it's just confusing right now, since light or particle, light is a particle, and you can just think of that as being our observable universe. The real point is, even if you wait forever, you would expect our universe, our observable universe to continue to grow with a radius growing one light year every year. And yes, that happens, but if you now ask, in the case of a static universe, we would live in an observable universe. We're sitting at the center of what we would perceive as our observable universe, and the radius of the sphere which we can be causally connected to would be growing by one light year for every year. And if we waited forever, it would encompass forever all of reality, because it would be slowly getting bigger at one light year per year. But because space is expanding, our observable piece is getting bigger, but the space out here is actually moving faster away than that light is able to go. So so we're actually not going to see everything. And that would be, the limit of that would be what I'm calling the event horizon. Let me come back to this one. Let's do this one. Okay, so the idea is that you might have an inflating matrix, and then at various spots in the inflating matrix, you have a quantum fluctuation in the so-called inflaton field or something else that causes inflation to slow down or stop. And when that happens, you will get regions forming where inflation stops. In this region, inflation is still happening. So these things are receding from one another at an incredible rate. But within each of these, the space-time has stopped inflating. And if you look within each of these and you ask, where are the event horizons, if you think of our event horizon, if you think of our event horizon as the size of a marble, and you ask how many marbles can exist in a bucket, then I'm drawing some marbles in these regions. So we can have regions where you have event horizons that are actually small compared to the region where the inflation stopped. We call this idea the bubble multiverse because you have different bubbles where the inflation might stop. The physical characteristics of the space-time might be different in these regions, which means the physical laws could be quite different here from here and different from here. So the universe as you might perceive it could be extremely different in these different regions. Within each of these regions, the basic physical laws would be the same, but this region can be vastly larger than the region of each event horizon. So if we are anthropocentric, we have an observable universe, we have an event horizon, so that is the region of our universe that we could ever experience. Within that, there may be a great reality outside of that that is very similar to ours, but we will never experience. And then there might be basically a boundary where you then go into inflating space-time, and then some other place way over here, you have some other region where inflation stopped and the physical laws are now very different. So these are two distinct multiverse ideas. And in fact, they could both be the case. In fact, if inflation happened, to my knowledge, we don't know how to avoid either of these multiverses. If you believe in inflation, both types of these multiverses just follow, and they're both there. So let's just look at one of these. Within our bubble, which is this region, we have potentially an infinite number of regions that are basically event horizon sized. They only differ by the nature of those initial quantum fluctuations in the structure. If I have an infinite number of them, then all possibilities happen. And in fact, all possibilities happened many times, enough to cover all quantum possibilities that could have happened. So this is where, at a cosmological level, people say that anything that could have happened has happened in the multiverse. Any initial condition that could be there has happened. So Elvis lives somewhere in the multiverse. There's an identical you talking to me somewhere in the multiverse. These are, again, independent of the idea of the many worlds, which is the quantum mechanical thing, which would also be happening. So it's pretty crazy. And Max Tegmark, in a paper Boy, I don't remember whether I'm have you read it or not. He actually will estimate the distance to the nearest identical you. And it is an absolutely outrageously large number. 10 to the 50 to the 100th power or some ridiculous distance. But when people talk about anything that could have happened, has happened in the multiverse, this is one of the concepts they're using. It's basically saying within our bubble, the great reality is so much larger than our small region that basically that initial set of conditions has been repeated such that anything that could happen has happened and there will be an identical you somewhere. Yes?
So in the last one, we're talking about physical laws not being seen.
Right. So now I have focused in on just one bubble. It's worse than that because... because you can have an infinite inflating matrix with an infinite number of these other bubbles, which might all have a very different sampling of all the possible physical parameters because the space could be. So this ties into string theory, so just sort of bear with it. In another lecture or two, I'm going to give you some motivation for why I'm sort of saying what I'm saying about the characteristics of the space-time. But basically a way to think about it is... I'll give you a little bit of a preview. In string theory, the belief is that there are more dimensions than we can actually measure, that the theory works in 11 dimensions, and there are mathematical ways to make those extra dimensions disappear. Okay, they're still there in the theory, but we cannot perceive them, and there are ways to make that happen. In fact, there are some 10 to the 500 ways of making that happen. And depending on how you twist up these extra dimensions such that you can't see them, you'll actually get different physical constants. So if you were to start out with some space-time happening and allow quantum fluctuations take place, you could actually form different realities in terms of what the physical constants are. And so initially in the idea in string theory, people had hoped that when they started looking carefully at things, they would find one solution for wrapping all these extra dimensions up and that was really preferred. And when they looked at that, lo and behold, they would find exactly the physical laws that we have in our universe, and boom, they've got their theory of everything. And this is what they were hoping for in the 1980s and early 90s. They were very excited about this. A lot of theorists were really going for it. What they've discovered since is that there is no preferred set that they can figure out. In fact, there are 10 to the 500 possibilities, and any of them could happen. So what you could have in this inflating matrix is each of these bubbles basically is one of these 10 to the 500 possible fluctuations of the space-time, and it will have its commensurate set of physical laws. Within each of those, you will have different sets of initial conditions, and you can have all possible variations within that set of physical laws. All possible variations could happen because this region could also be very large relative to the size of a so-called event horizon. The characteristics of some of these are such that actually the space-time won't exist very long. It just won't happen. Sometimes you can have things such that what we think of as our Big Bang would never have been around long enough to form stars, or maybe it expands so fast that that you don't form stars because things expand too fast for gravity to allow things to condense. So there are many, many solutions. In fact, probably the vast majority of the 10 to the 500 solutions where basically it'd be unrecognizable to us in terms of anything remotely like what we have. So in the quantum mechanical many-worlds multiverse, we have the idea that basically anything that could happen could have happened. Cosmologically, within our bubble, we have the idea that anything that could have happened within our physical laws. And then it gets worse than that because you can have variations in those physical laws and anything that could happen has happened according to that. So, yeah.
The universes collide with one another?
this is inflating, so you're not going to have them collide with one another. Well, maybe I'm speaking too fast. That I think may well depend on how dense you have these fluctuations that can cause inflation to stop, and the detailed nature of how it happens. I do know people worry a bit about that. I think you could have a quantum fluctuation in the space-time here that starts inflating. So that would certainly chew up that bubble in principle. I mean, I wouldn't ignore making contributions to my IRA because I'm expecting that to happen. But, yeah.
Can the event horizons overlap?
They do. Yeah, they do. Because all I'm trying to do is get a measure of how many of our universe type size objects might there be. So basically, you can imagine having a bucket of sand and then asking how many marble sized regions of sand exist. But for any bit of sand, you know, you don't really have a marble boundary there. I mean, it's sand, so it's continuous, so that would be the better picture. But if you're wanting to count possibilities, then you want to do the counting in terms of universe size objects, where when I say universe there, I mean event horizon size objects. So that's why I'm using it that way. Okay, so I sort of said that. I guess I've said that. All right. Okay, so there are several important things that I hope are coming out of this. One is that there are different multiverse concepts, and they could all be happening at the same time. So it's really hard for me to imagine anything more perverse than multiple multiverses. but that's the most likely scenario, okay, in terms of if you believe in inflation. The other thing is, when we started this class, and if you go back and you look at the taxonomy I threw in there, with our definition of universe, and we started talking about multiverse, there are lots of possible concepts. There is the idea of the computational multiverse, which I think we talked about, right? We talked about that. So you could be a simulation. There's the idea of heaven and hell and different planes of existence and stuff like that. These multiverse ideas, I mean, I cannot step out into the great reality and show you these different regions. What I can say is that quantum field theory is a framework that has worked extremely well for very detailed experiments in the laboratory. It accounts for everything that we can really get our hands on in terms of studying the strong nuclear interaction, the weak nuclear interaction, and the electromagnetic force. General relativity works really well. We have compelling evidence for the Big Bang, and the idea of inflation is something that actually fits in terms of quantum field theory. There's a way to do it, and it answers the problems of the Big Bang. And I'm going to show you some, I mean, we do actually have some evidence that maybe inflation happened. And what I'm trying to leave you with, the point I'm trying to make is, if inflation happened, I don't think anyone knows how to avoid these multiverses. And it's sort of funny, if I go into a faculty meeting over in the physics department and I start talking about a multiverse, I'll get some snickering. Okay? There's like, basically, if you took a vote, most of them wouldn't say anything. If I didn't say a word about a multiverse and I said, what about inflation? Do you think of, how about inflation? Do you agree with that? I mean, what do you think about that? I think most of the physicists in the room would actually agree there's a pretty compelling case for inflation. What many of them haven't actually done is to they haven't looked into this enough to realize that if you have inflation, these multiverse ideas just follow directly from that. So, I mean, when I started digging into this, I was pretty skeptical. And then I sort of reached that point, and I thought, wow, because inflation, while not a smoking gun scientifically, is pretty compelling scientifically. And there are not a lot of, I mean, I'm going to give you one competing example. There's not a lot of stuff out there that really competes with it. So, I mean, I don't think of these multiverses, the ones I just described, as ideas that are really pulled out of thin air. I think I can't call them really scientific in that we haven't proven them, but I also don't think that they're just, I think it's more than just metaphysics, because they are inferred from pretty solid stuff. So it's pretty strange. Any rate, let's pull back a little bit from the multiverse into things that are a bit more real, but perhaps surprising. So the inflationary Big Bang model, I hope you're something of a believer in. The standard model of particle physics, I've talked a lot about. We have a vast amount of evidence that supports both of these, basically. We know that we haven't really proven the inflation bit, and we know that there are holes in this in terms of our understanding. So we certainly are missing some pieces. So one of the important pieces that I have not really talked about, which is a fairly interesting piece, is called dark matter. And this is, again, basically something where you might look at it and go, well who the hell ordered that? Total surprise. It was first predicted by a guy named Fritz Zwicky, who is a Caltech astrophysicist who, let me remember when. It's like the 30s or 40s, the 1930s or 40s, I think he suggested this. This guy is a real character. I mean, he did a lot of work that led to jet engines. He had one of my favorite quotes of a scientist. He would refer to some of his less than favorite people as spherical bastards, because they were bastards no matter how you looked at them. And he actually also suggested that gravitational lensing could happen, which is something that we were actually using as a technique in astronomy today. And he inferred the existence of dark matter, whatever that is. So how he inferred the existence of dark matter is he was studying the motions of galaxies in a galactic cluster. And here's a picture of the cluster of galaxies he happened to be studying. And so you can basically see a number of galaxies in here. And you could tell that they're associated in a cluster by basically looking at their redshift and find that they have a similar redshift. So they basically are in one fixed area of the sky and moving more or less together. And what he did was he looked at the relative motion of these various galaxies. And he estimated the mass of the galactic cluster using a couple of different methods. One was looking at just the number and the brightness of each of the galaxies. And that's not completely pulled out of thin air, because astronomers actually know a great deal about what's inside stars and what's inside galaxies, and you know, they can estimate numbers of stars and things like that. So you can look at the brightness of a galaxy and come up with a reasonable estimate of the mass. And then he also looked at the motion of the galaxies near the edge of the cluster. And generally speaking, just like the motion of the planets you can use to get an estimate of how much mass the sun has, because the way in which they move is dictated by how hard they're pulled toward the center, if you want to think about it like that. You can look at the motion of the galaxies around the edge of the cluster and infer what must be the gravitational attraction of those galaxies toward the center of the cluster. And from that, from each of these two methods, he was able to infer a mass for the galactic cluster. And what he found was that when he looked at the motion of the galaxies, he got a number that was like a factor of 10 higher than he got if he estimated it from the number and the brightness of the galaxies. So he said, well, if I believe this, then it means that there's a whole lot of mass in this cluster that I can't see. It's not associated with this luminous matter, and I'll just call it dark matter. So he said, this sort of sat and bubbled in the community. It's not that people looked and said, you're wrong. Just people, what the hell do you make of that? Was basically the idea. And there was nothing else to sort of feed into it until some number of years later, 1975, a woman named Vera Rubin and a fellow named Kent Ford at the Carnegie Institution in Washington looked at a nearby galaxy and did a similar study, but in this case, instead of looking at the motion of galaxies in a galactic cluster, they looked at the velocity of stars around the core of a galaxy. And they plotted the velocity of the stars as a function of the distance from the galactic center. And if you use the information that people have about the density distribution of luminous matter in a galaxy and made a prediction as to what the velocity distribution of the stars around the galactic center should look like as a function of distance from the galactic center, you would get this blue curve. You expect that velocity to drop off as you get very, very far away from the center of the galaxy. And it turned out that what they observed was very different. And you could take this and make it look like that in your theory if indeed you assumed there was some distribution of matter about 10 times more than you could see in the galaxy. And this then wasn't, I think, I mean, it caused quite a commotion in 1975. And because somehow when it's a galactic cluster, it's a tough measurement to make. I think maybe people feel, well, that's so far away, I don't know. But this is a nearby galaxy. You can see the stars in powerful telescopes. So all of a sudden, people took this pretty seriously. Other people repeated the measurement. They saw the same thing. And basically, the idea of dark matter became a big puzzle at that point. So I guess here's just another slide that says basically the same thing. So you look at the stars, you're looking at the speed of the stars rotating around as a function of distance from the center. And just to remind you, I think we saw this early in the semester, but if you imagine something's moving in a circle, the force that keeps it moving in a circle has to be equal to the mass of the object times the velocity squared of the object divided by its radius. So this would be classical physics, but basically the velocity of the object around the center depends on the mass that you would have inside it. So this is just to motivate the fact that you can find this relationship. So people have had to think about this. There's strong evidence that there's a great deal of matter in the universe that we cannot actually see, that does not interact with electromagnetism, because if it did, we would see it. If you take that much additional matter and you put it into Big Bang models and you allow it to interact like the strong interaction, it will screw up everything in the Big Bang models. So the belief is that this dark matter, whatever it is, also does not interact like the strong interaction. Similarly, there are reasons to believe that it might interact very, very weakly, so sort of like neutrinos. So it's electrically neutral, and we call it non-baryonic, which means it's not made of protons and neutrons, so it's not like normal matter, because if it were, it would interact strongly. Okay, because protons and neutrons will interact with quarks and stuff. So the belief is that the majority of the mass in the universe, actually, we can't see, and we can only infer its existence from its interaction with gravity. So these rotation curves, for example. We have one example that is often cited as evidence for dark matter that is sort of interesting. What you see here is a galactic cluster and another galactic cluster that have literally collided. And when they collided, there was most of the mass in the galactic cluster is actually in the form of intergalactic gas, hydrogen gas and stuff. And when these things collided, the hydrogen gas basically would slow down the hydrogen gas. And so as this cluster went through that cluster, the hydrogen gas was sort of left behind. And so what you see in pink here is an image taken from an X-ray telescope that basically images the hydrogen gas in these clusters. And it is sort of left behind. What you see in blue is not a true optical blue. I mean, you have the optical image overlaid, which you can see with the bright white spots and stuff of the galaxies. What is in blue is the calculated distribution of the mass in the galactic clusters according to how the mass distorts the optical images from things that are very far behind, using the fact that mass bends light, so using gravitational lensing. So what people infer from this is that these two galactic clusters pass through each other. The majority of the luminous mass is slowed down and stays in the pink, but the actual most of the mass that's in the clusters just passes right through. So those are the regions that are actually bending the light. And that's the dark matter. We don't actually see it. We can't take a real camera and see the blue. We're only inferring the existence of the distribution of the dark matter by the way in which it distorts light behind it, which you can't really see in this picture. So this is another you've got one example that people have found. Yes?
So dark matter interacts with gravitational force?
Yes. Yes, dark matter has mass. All right, so I'm going to come back. Okay. All right, so remember that we have the picture of the universe at 400,000 years, the cosmic microwave background. We can study the sizes of the spots here and how often sizes of different size spots happen. And let me rephrase that. If I have a theory of a Big Bang happening, I'm starting out with a pot of material that has certain properties and interactions, okay? And I basically let it expand and cool, and I ask, what did I end up with at 400,000 years? And if I started out with a pattern of quantum fluctuations, what I end up with when the cosmic microwave background is formed depends on the nature of the matter in here. A way to think about that would be, suppose I had a dense bit of gas right here. It would diffuse out. So if I create a dense bit of gas again and again by waving my hand, if I did it fast enough, these waves, density waves, would actually propagate out and you would hear them as sound. Okay, that's what sound is. So the speed of sound depends on the very nature of the material itself. The speed of sound varies depending on the density, temperature of the gas, or whether it's moving through a solid or whatever. The sizes of these spots are dictated, basically, you start out with these energy fluctuations in the early universe. You can think of those as density perturbations because they'll turn into matter. So you have density perturbations. And those density perturbations will propagate just like sound in a gas, in a sense. It's very tenuous. It's hard to sort of imagine that. But these density fluctuations, the cosmologists actually call an acoustical signal, because it's just like sound. And the speed with which they move in the medium and the size that they are depends on the nature of the medium. It depends, for example, on how much dark matter there is or not. And so when you look at this picture, there's a huge amount of information here. And if I start out with a pot of matter that includes a bunch of dark matter, or I start out with a pot of matter that has no dark matter, I will get a different pattern here. I will get a different frequency of different sized dots. So it turns out that this picture has within it the ability to distinguish what the crud in the early universe really was. And so people then have done a lot of this with this. And so the idea is to look and analyze how frequently you see spots of different sizes. So what you see here is the number of spots you see, and what you see here is of which size. So if I go to L equal 2, I would be looking at a sky like this. So I'm looking at huge spots. If I go to L equals 16, the spots get much smaller. So exactly what the math is, you don't need to worry about. But basically, this is a measure of the sizes of the spots. And so what one sees is that there's a very particular pattern that's observed. And if I now do a cosmological theory with different amounts of stuff, I will find that I will get a different curve. And so this curve, which is an analysis of the sizes and frequencies of the spots in this cosmic microwave background, has a lot of information. We call it a power spectrum. And what comes out of that is this. Okay? What it says is that all the stuff that we're used to, the normal matter in the universe, is 4% of the energy budget in the universe. The rest of the normal matter, okay, so that would be this. The rest of the normal matter, that is matter that interacts with gravity normally, is dark matter. So 80% of the matter in the universe, we can't even see, and we don't know what it is yet. And then, in order to make the space of the universe flat and match the spectrum, it turns out you have to have a term in Einstein's equations that basically take some 80% of the energy in the universe, and it has to go in that dark energy term, which is causing this accelerating expansion in the universe. So you can look at this and say, we don't even know what 95% of our universe happens to be. But we do have now pretty strong evidence for something called dark energy and very compelling evidence for something called dark matter that are the biggest puzzles in physics today that people are trying to solve. And it comes mostly from this cosmic microwave background picture, which was independent of the rotation curves of galaxies. So at least the dark matter spot has, you know, yet another piece of evidence. So I'm out of time. I should stop there. So. Go enjoy your 4%.